Hey everyone, it's Dr. Jordan here, and from everyone at Barbell Medicine, we want to say thank you for all of your support this year. Truly, we couldn't do what we do without you, so in the spirit of Thanksgiving and the holiday weekend, thank you so much. And with that in mind, I wanted to tell you about our biggest sale of the year going on this weekend only. From now through Monday, everything on the website is on sale. You can take 20% off our one-on-one coaching from some of the most experienced coaches in the game. We only do this once a year, so if you're on the fence about working with a professional coach, there's no better time than now. Outside of coaching, our training templates, whey protein, PeriRx supplement, and our freshly restocked apparel are all marked down 20% as well. We're even discounting our Barbell Medicine Plus membership for a limited time only, so you can get ad-free listening, exclusive content, and support what we do here at Barbell Medicine for up to 30% off. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/shop and check it out. You can stock up on gifts for your favorite workout enthusiast with special deals on coaching, apparel, templates, supplements, and more. That's barbellmedicine.com/shop. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and thanks again.
Shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Crocs, Old Navy Outlet, American Eagle Outfitters, Kay Jewelers, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com. Big time deals on big name brands.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is the November 2024 Research Review. If you haven't joined us for Barbell Medicine Research Review before, what we do is we take some of the most recently published scientific literature, we break it down for you, we interpret it as best as we can, and we try to give you some practical take-home, some pearls, if you will. So we're going to talk about all sorts of weird stuff today. One, like detraining in the middle of 10-week training blocks, and then also carbon monoxide inhalation for gains. Yeah. I did not misspeak. That's what we're going to talk about. It's pretty nutty, and we'll talk some training in the beginning here.
Has science gone too far?
Yeah, science gone too far. That one weird trick to blow up your VO2 max. That silky smooth voice on the other end of the line is the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Chilling. Yeah, well,
that's it. All right. He's doing okay. Unremarkable. I like that. I suspect if things were bad or good, you would have remarked about it. So I don't even know why I ask. But, you know, we were riffing about some training related discussion for some upcoming projects and articles and such. And it's this idea about how quickly you can make progress. So does it matter how fast people get stronger or gain muscle size? For example, you could use that as an outcome when they start training. We both agree that the answer to that is just generally no, with my sort of caveat being that if somebody is very sort of outcome driven, right, and the weight on the bar or, you know, measurements of muscle size or whatever really sort of is the glue that keeps them adherent to the program, then I'm like, well, you kind of have to select for that so that they're bit by the exercise bug, I suppose, although I don't know how that works long term for them, because at some point they're going to hit a wall and then you got to sort of reevaluate, retool. But what's your overall thoughts on like the importance of maybe adaptive rate in beginners, how to maximizing adaptive rate as being like a core principle of programming and progression?
Yeah, I think that once you're in the ballpark of reasonable, generally accepted as reasonable programming principles, we'll call it GRA, whatever that acronym is that they use in accounting. Once you're in that ballpark, I think that the rate of adaptation is a lot less within your control than you think. There are going to be people who blow up, who gain, you know, muscle, who gain strength really, really quickly. And those are probably kind of more your outliers, your genetic anomalies. It's almost like a selection bias / survivorship bias of people who can tolerate that amount of training and who respond really well to it, right? So I'm thinking about this on the fly here. I'm imagining like four quadrant breakdown of people in terms of phenotypes, those who respond really well and those who don't respond as well, and those who tolerate a lot of training well and those who don't tolerate a lot of training well. And you can end up with kind of four different types of people. The freaks who respond really well and tolerate the training, that's the survivorship bias plus selection bias. They can make it through the gauntlet, they can respond really well, and they end up coming out as freaks at the other end. Then you have people who respond really well, but don't tolerate, you know, the training super well. So they might get strong really, really fast and then might experience some injury setbacks. And then those are the lifters who blow up early and then you never hear from them again. And then other types who maybe don't respond quite as well, but tolerate a lot of training. And so for them, they might not make, you know, rapid early progress. I identify, I suppose, as this person, but it took me much longer to accumulate the adaptations necessary to manifest a high level of performance with, you know, a decent amount of setbacks along the way for various types of training intolerance, I'll call it, various tendinopathies, aches, pains, tweaks that some of my, like, when I've coached high level competitors, I'm like, damn, this person's invincible. Like, I cannot break them with the training I'm giving them. And then finally, the last category, the person who neither adapts really well nor tolerates training really well. And that's a sad place to be, but you just need a lot more trial and error and experimentation, because most people, you can find some sort of a training setup and like regulation strategy that can get them to tolerate training. It's just what's their ceiling on how far they're going to go. And generally, it's going to be lower than the other group.
Yeah, I kind of view those main two archetypes as like the tortoise and the hare on some level. Like in this case, I'm the hare and you're the tortoise, right? If we look back at our first years of like formalized barbell training,
yeah,
you know, I squatted 500 within the first year of barbell training. I benched 365 for a double. And I deadlifted 545, right? Now, none of those are like world beater numbers, but for the first year of actually touching a barbell, decidedly above average, right? Whereas you were about half of that on all of your numbers, right? And so if you just, you know, cross section at that 12 month mark and you're like, who do you predict to be a better power lifter, right? Or have a higher 1RM in 5 years?
Yeah.
You would probably pick me, right? I mean, just that's probably what most people would pick, just given my adaptive rate early on. However, 15 years later, we're about at the same spot, you know, with
our 1RMs are within probably a percent or two of each other.
Pretty close. Yeah, we weigh about the same. We lift, I mean, similarly, it just depends on the season of life and such. And so I think the takeaway there, now granted, people say, oh, isn't that anecdotal evidence? That's just you guys reflecting your experience. Well, sure. But it is also borne out in evidence when you look at long-term data sets on like how people respond and the not only inter-individual variation, but how does like current success predict future success in sports performance or even particularly barbell sports performance. And so I think, there's this rush initially, like you got to get as strong as possible, as big as possible, as quickly as possible. And it's like, well, none of these things happen really quickly anyway to a significant effect where you'd be like, dang, I made it.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a lifelong pursuit. Just like almost anything else worth doing is like a long-term pursuit. So I think the most important thing probably is like getting bit by the bug and finding out different things that you prefer and respond well to, and while also simultaneously finding out things that I don't like this so much / doesn't really work for me right now as a person. Doesn't mean you're closed off to it forever, but just being able to provide more feedback on like, here are things that I've identified that I like and that work for me, at least right now. Things that don't, I think those are all maybe the goals of like the initial sort of training phase, if you wanted to call it that.
Yeah, it's super interesting to contrast having been, you know, spent many, many years in like the more aerobic conditioning endurance type world, and then also training for a long time and achieving a decent level of performance in the strength world. The difference in thought process around this, and I think because of the ease of weight on the bar as like a metric of outcome, since you said like those who are very outcome oriented get very addicted to the number on the bar and wanting to push that up and viewing that as, you know, the main metric of progress to be chased and to maximize as quickly as possible. Whereas that's not really something that you see in the other world. And what I mean by that is there, the time is the outcome, right? So like how fast you run something, sprint something, cycle something. And there's not any sort of coaching paradigm there where they're like, okay, so I got this kid, he's showing up to start, you know, his first day as like a novice, you know, track athlete. Today, he's going to run a 100-meter dash in 25 seconds because he's, I don't know, 10 years old or whatever. Well, okay, next week he's going to come back. I'm programming him to run it in 24 seconds. The next week he's coming back, I'm programming him to run it in 23 seconds. That's how you progressively overload. That sounds nonsensical because it kind of is. You just like, you get faster by like running faster versus the way that it's thought of in strength training, where that is almost, you know, accepted a lot of places, like, oh, I'm going to deliberately program for you the performance that I expect you to do. And as you do it, that's going to become evidence of your adaptations. Like, well, you have all this backwards, really. And so that's kind of the messaging that we're trying to push back against is, it would be great if we had a very easy, cheap, intuitive, accurate, reliable measure of like force production, right? Because weight on the bar is not a measure of force production. Weight on the bar is the resistance. Your force production impacts how fast that resistance moves, right?
Yeah.
So if we had a great measure of it, like bar speed velocity trackers are like close, but again, they are also like effort dependent to some extent. But if you assume that the person or get the person exerting maximum effort, then sure, that's a metric of force production. And if that was a way that people viewed their strength training adaptations, I think a lot of programming decisions people would make very differently than they do when it's based on what's the weight on the bar.
Mm. Yeah. 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 If it had some sort of like a unitless readout, we're like, oh, your force production value, let's call it A. You're having an A day today. So yeah. That would tell you that, look, if everything's aligned, you know, chakra, your meridians, the lunar phase, the music that's on in the gym, you might be able to add weight today, do more reps, or otherwise see an increase in performance. It's the same thing you see in endurance sort of training, right? If your VO2 max goes up, sure, that's a critical determinant of endurance performance, but it's not the sole determinant of endurance performance. You need other stuff to be in your favor to actually run a mile faster, for example, row a 5K faster. Again, things that are outside of your control. So having maybe some sort of input there would be helpful. And we've tried and continue to try to come up with like extensive different ways to like predict how, not only how strong you're going to be, but what the performance is actually going to be, so we can sort of match the training to the individual. So definitely some food for thought. But one recurring sort of thing I see in across most sports or recreational activities by the people who have done them at a high level for a long period of time, like the number one sort of piece of advice is, hey, find a way to have fun doing this. I'm reminded, there's this tweet that just came from Max Homa. He's a professional golfer on the PGA Tours, won a bunch of tournaments, and a good SoCal boy. And he's got his Twitter's an excellent follow. Even if you don't like golf, he's just witty and also some salt, which I appreciate. There's a rule in golf where if you hit the ball into the fairway, for example, and the ball rolls into a divot that somebody else either didn't repair or it's in various states of disrepair, you can't move the ball. Yeah, you hit a great shot, you hit the fairway, but you're in a divot, you're SOL. And so they were like, Max, should we change this rule in golf? And he goes, no. If you are a casual golfer, not playing tournaments, and I can't stress this enough, do whatever you want. This game sucks and is impossible. Just have fun. which is kind of the way I feel about powerlifting, right? Like people will ask this very like minutia related question. And I'm like, I don't think that really matters. Find a way to have fun, especially if you're not getting paid for this, if it's not being televised. And, you know, if you are at that level and it does represent a significant portion of your identity, I can empathize with that. But at the same time, I would encourage therapy then in that case. So you can figure out.
Yeah, it's the absurdist approach. I'm down with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Everything's chaos. All right. Well, let's get into the research review here. First paper here is going to be about, does taking a break matter? Adaptations in muscle strength and size between continuous and periodic resistance training. This is done by a research group out of Finland with the lead author, Halonen, and his crew, published in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports. Great journal, by the way. Most of their papers are also open access, which is kind of nice. So you don't have to go down the rabbit hole of stealing this stuff online or requesting like library, you know, your librarian to pull it. All right, so some background here. In exercise, detraining is the reduction in strength, power, muscle size, and or endurance as the result of insufficient exercise. The degree of performance reduction is related to the length or duration of detraining, where longer periods tend to produce greater decreases in performance. And it also matters what the cause, what is the reason for the period of detraining. So for example, if it's illness, if it's some sort of injury or other reason to be immobilized, that's likely to cause more detraining over a given period of time than simply not engaging in formal exercise. You can imagine, you know, somebody had a fracture, for example, and their arm's immobilized for a period of time versus just not exercising for that period of time and not being immobilized. Yeah, you're going to have differential sort of outcomes there. In any case, there is a common narrative in exercise that training continuously without time off is universally better than a sort of intermittent or periodic approach to exercise. Some even suggest that continuous training builds upon itself, leading to better strength and muscle gains than an intermittent approach. So this study set out to investigate that idea by comparing two groups of untrained adults, one that trained for 20 weeks in a row and another that trained for two 10-week blocks separated by a 10-week detraining period. Let's see how they did it. So the study design for this particular paper, they took 55 adults, so both men and women. They were aged 18 to 40. They were healthy, but otherwise untrained. Okay. One group called the periodic resistance training group did 10 weeks of resistance training, then 10 weeks of no resistance training, and then 10 more weeks of resistance training, so 30 weeks in total. The continuous resistance training group started out with 10 weeks of no training. That was effectively the control group just to see like, hey, does this 10-week strength training program actually improve strength compared to somebody who's not exercising? And then they did 20 weeks consecutively of resistance training. The resistance training itself looked to be pretty reasonable. They did about 16 sets per week for each of the major muscle groups, sets of 8 to 10. They did leg press, knee extension, Smith machine bench press, barbell biceps curl, of course, because this is an exercise science study, and you cannot do an exercise science study without biceps curls. They know what's up. And they also did a chest-supported row. As far as outcomes, they tested maximum strength. So this was pretty cool. At the first 10 weeks, they were testing max strength every other week prior to the second group starting the resistance training just to see like, hey, is this thing working or not? And then during the training period, they tested one rep max every 5 weeks just to see again, like what is the sort of rate of improvement? And that's actually, I think, something that should be part of most strength training studies. Because it's like, yeah, you can tell us what happened at the end of the study, but how quickly did that happen? Was it a quick run up and then it plateaued, or did it like they keep getting better over time? That's something that's kind of missing from a lot of the strength training data. They also tested muscle size using ultrasound, and they tested a counter movement jump height. So they just measured how quickly or how high people could jump if they did a counter movement before that vertical jump. All right. So for results, first off, adherence was great. Over 92.5%. So that means people were doing the program, so to speak. The training volume load or tonnage, which is sets times reps times load used, was identical in both groups. It was just distributed differently. Again, the periodic resistance training group did 10 weeks on, 10 weeks off, and then 10 weeks on again, whereas the continuous group did 20 weeks in a row. The first 10 weeks of the study period, they were not exercising. So as far as comparing, like, does this exercise program work compared to not exercising? Yep. The initial comparison for the leg press 1RM compared to not training, the leg press one rep max went up about 16.6%. The leg press 1RM went up about 20% in the first 10 weeks. Pretty good. They also saw a 16.6% increase in the size of the vastus lateralis. That's the muscle belly on the outside of the quadriceps muscle group. And the biceps curl, one rep max, because you got to test that again, it's exercise science study, went up about 25% compared to those who weren't exercising. And it saw a 17.1% increase in muscle cross-sectional area. Finally, the counter movement jump went up about 17.8%. That's about 4.5 centimeters in the group that was lifting weights compared to the group that wasn't. So all that tells me is that, yep, this program actually worked, made people stronger. Neat. Let's compare now those who did the periodic resistance training to the continuous resistance training. Okay, so this is over the whole 30-week study period. We look at the leg press in the periodic resistance training group. They started with a one rep max of about 165 kilos, which is what, 363 pounds. And it went up in the first 10-week block to almost 200 kilos. So just shy of that, which is 440 pounds. During the 10-week detraining period, it went down by about 10 kilos, 22 pounds. To 187.5 kilos, so still stronger than when they first started out, but not quite their peak. And then it ended at the second 10-week training period at 209 kilos, so about 461 pounds. So they improved their one rep max leg press by 44 kilos, which is pretty good. During the detraining period, yeah, they lost about 5.5%, but they still ended up starting higher on the second 10-week block, and they ended even higher than that. Comparatively, the continuous resistance training group, that's the group that trained 20 weeks in a row. Yep, their one rep max started at 165 kilos as well, 363 pounds, and went up to 207 kilos at the end of the 20 weeks, so a 41 kilogram difference. And yeah, if you're listening at home, you're like, well, the periodic group went up by 44 kilos and the continuous group went up by 41. So maybe it's better to split up my training. That's not actually statistically significant in this particular study. Not enough subjects. And ultimately, that 3 kilo difference in strength testing is kind of like a shoulder shrug. Not only not statistically significant, but clinically significant. No, it's not that either. For the biceps curl, the periodic resistance training group increased from 28 kilos to start to 36.7 kilos on average for their one rep max. That's an 8.8 kilo average gain in 1RM biceps curl performance. The continuous group went from 28.9 kilos to start to 36.2 kilos at the end. That's a 7.7 kilo improvement in 1RM performance. As far as muscle size goes, in the periodic resistance training group with the 10-week break in the middle, they went from 26 centimeters squared to 31.3 centimeters squared for the vastus lateralis. That's about a 5.2 square centimeter average growth. Whereas the continuous group, they increased by about 6.4 square centimeters squared. And for the biceps, because again, we do care about how much the biceps are growing, the periodic resistance training group gained about 2.2 square centimeters for average growth. And the continuous group gained about 2.4 square centimeters over the 20-week training period. And finally, counter movement jump. There was about a 4.8 centimeter gain overall in the periodic group and then about 3.7 centimeters in the continuous group. So some interesting things here, just results, and then we'll wrap about this, Dr. Baraki. Strength and size gain were actually a bit higher as far as how much was gained in the first 5 weeks of retraining, so that second 10-week block. It actually took them about 5 weeks of retraining to regain and surpass their previous training's peak strength and size from the first 10 weeks. And compared to the continuous resistance training group, who are now in training weeks 10 through 15, the periodic resistance training group was making more efficient gains. They were getting stronger, faster, gaining more size faster. So for example, the leg press 1RM improved nearly twice as much in the periodic resistance training group compared to the continuous resistance training group in these 5 weeks. And the leg cross-sectional area, the size increased nearly five times as much during these 5 week period. So this rate of improvement, which we call the adaptation rate, was the same in both the 5 weeks of the retraining and the first 5 weeks that these people ever worked out. So they were like newbies all over again, which calls into question this idea of like muscle memory, for example, which we'll talk about. But most importantly, there were no differences in strength, size, or changes in counter movement improvements between groups at the end of the 30 weeks, meaning that over the course of the 30 weeks, it didn't matter if you trained 20 weeks in a row or if you separated with the 10-week detraining period in the middle, you still ended up at the same spot on average. So before I go any further with interpretation, I just kind of reported the study to you, Dr. Baraki. How does that strike you?
In one sense, it's a bit disappointing because you and I both really enjoy training, and we train not just continuously, but continuously for very, very, very long periods of time. Now, I would not kind of extrapolate this study that was done on, as you mentioned, about 55 untrained kind of beginners to lifting to very experienced lifters who've been doing this for decades plus. I think that there's obviously some gaps there that would not be you couldn't translate one of those scenarios to the other. But it is good news in many other senses for a lot of folks, in terms of it is reasonable for them to be kind to themselves when life gets in the way of training, when there are setbacks, when there are, you know, situations where you might not be able to adhere to a very, very rigid program on an every single basis and do every single set and rep that is programmed for you. You can likely get just as good of gains over the, you know, medium to long term, even with some of these imperfections in your programming. There are certainly going to be some people who are highly motivated by having a rigid program that they can try to stick to, but it is still pretty beneficial to recognize that this is a pretty forgiving process, particularly over very long time periods. And so that gives people a lot of room, not just to, you know, for things to be okay when they don't go your way, but also, as we mentioned at the very top of this podcast, that like, having some fun is also okay. Like, right. So if your main goal, say your primary goal is I want to be able to squat, you know, 400 pounds or 500 pounds or 300 pounds, whatever that goal is, it's also arguably okay if your training is not singularly focused on that particular outcome year round until you get there. Like, it's okay to do other things, to take a break from one thing, to, you know, to kind of adjust these things to facilitate, be it psychological enjoyment, motivation, adherence over time, and you're going to be fine if you do that in the long term.
Totally. Yeah. My take on it is, first, a few things. One, that reasonably programmed resistance training, which again, whatever the accounting term you were trying to call back earlier, that's the term I want to use, but neither of us know what that is off the top of our head. But reasonably programmed resistance training is effective for increasing strength and size in most people. I would have liked to see the spread across different people just to see like what's the range, because that would have been interesting to discuss yet for the 100th time or so on our podcast. But sure, reasonably programmed resistance training is effective for increasing strength and size. No surprise there. To me, though, the more striking sort of takeaway here is that the total amount of training done over a period of time is probably more important than how it's distributed, as there are no differences over 30 weeks in either protocol. Now, had the continuous training group trained for all 30 weeks instead of just the 20, just the last 20, I would expect there to be a difference in outcomes favoring the group that trained more, did more training volume, more training load, all that sort of stuff, right? I would expect that to be the case. But if you're comparing, they did two sessions per week on average, right, over 20 weeks. So that's 40 total sessions. If you compared 40 total sessions to maybe 50 total sessions or 55 total sessions in the same time period, if I had no other information, I would predict the group that trained more would have a better result. And that's just because of the relationship we know between not only training volume, but also just a total training load tending to be the more predictive sort of exercise programming variable rather than something just like how many weeks they were training for or the frequency or the distribution. Mm-hmm. It's not the end of the world if you have to take some time off, though it's probably best if you don't have to and you can just train continuously for a long period of time. Some other interesting things here have to do with detraining and the sort of muscle memory thing. So again, just to go back to detraining, this does tend to occur proportionally to the duration of the detraining period, but not all detraining is equal. In situations where there's illness, injury, and or immobilization, strength loss seems to predominate over muscle size loss. And in detraining periods where people are healthy but not necessarily training, muscle mass loss may outpace strength loss. That's what they actually found in this study. They lost more muscle mass than strength over the 10-week detraining period, although that isn't a universal finding. They presented it in this study like that was something that happens all the time, but I've actually did a pretty long research review on this, the podcast, What Happens When You Stop Lifting? I don't know the episode number off the top of my head, but some evidence shows that that's not necessarily the case. So for example, in strength athletes, so powerlifters and Division I college football players who had an average one rep max bench press of 330 pounds and a one rep max squat of 462 pounds, well, they showed virtually no strength or size loss after 2 weeks of detraining. So obviously a more highly trained set of individuals there. They certainly were training for longer than 10 weeks prior to those 1RM tests. But yeah, 2 weeks for them, that they didn't see any measurable sort of detraining. In a group of previously untrained adolescents who lifted weights for 3 months and increased their back squat one rep max by an average of 20 kilos, 3 weeks of training cessation, so detraining, did not significantly reduce muscle size or strength. Again, no real decrease there. Even in older individuals, one study showed that despite not losing any muscle size, leg strength decreased 15% after 4 weeks of detraining in a group of older individuals who had previously been strength training for 4 months. So there's some differential sort of effects here. The last one I'll mention is a recent meta-analysis on older adults who were previously untrained and then lifted weights regularly for periods of 2 to 6 months and then stopped. Muscle size loss wasn't significant until about 6 months after the detraining period had started, despite losing strength after only 1 month of detraining. So there does seem to be this disconnect between strength loss and muscle size loss. And to me, the way I think about this conceptually is it just matters why you're detrained, right? Again, if it's chronic illness, if it's an immobilization thing, if it's an injury, I suspect strength loss is going to be far greater, far more greater than muscle size loss. If you're just taking a break under a short period of time, I almost predict no real loss until significant time has passed. And at that point, I actually suspect that strength loss will outpace muscle mass loss if you're otherwise active, nutritionally sound, you know, not malnourished and such stuff like that. Does that kind of jive with your take on that?
Yeah, I think one of the this gets to the heart of what is strength performance and what are the variables that go into it. And one huge component is the skill component, the neurological component, you know, recruiting the muscles, coordinating the muscles to contract and generate that force to do the task. And then the other aspect is actually the muscle cross-sectional area, the force producing units in the muscle. And it is not a perfect relationship between the two as far as our performance goes. And I can think of personal experiences in my own training where, for example, you know, maybe I was at the peak of my strength or near peak strength performance, and maybe I had a setback and maybe I had an ache, pain, injury, and had to go into a little bit more of a rehab mode where I was like staying generally quite active, both in my day-to-day life, moving around, doing my normal activities, but I was still in the gym doing other activities. Might have been, you know, lower load stuff, different variations, higher rep stuff, you know, all sorts of other activities. Generally keeping the muscles stimulated in some way. And those are scenarios where I would not have detected very much, if any, actual muscle loss. My weight would have stayed stable, you know, body composition would have stayed stable. But going through that rehab process, if you had tested my strength performance, you know, at the other end, it would be down a lot, you know, relatively speaking for me, just because the skill component, the practice component of that task, I as you mentioned recently, you know, you hadn't done a one rep max or top heavy single effort in say 6 months, that skill takes some time to build back up again. So you could even argue for yourself right now that your peak strength performance as measured by a one rep max is relatively detrained, whereas your muscle mass is not detrained. It may even be greater than it was, you know, prior to 6 months ago as a result of your training. So there is that disconnect there based on what you're training and how you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which brings me to the last sort of discussion point here that people ask a lot of questions about. It is kind of this black box. It's the black box of muscle memory. Ooh. What is muscle memory? The muscle remembers. This is like a homeopathic muscle.
Oh, God.
Like it remembers where you're at. Well, muscle memory describes an improved efficiency of gaining strength and or muscle size in an individual who returns to training after a period of detraining. There are a few mechanisms that are thought to be responsible. The first is this myonuclear permanence hypothesis. Now, myonuclei, so that's where you get the myonuclear name from, these are muscle cell nuclei, and each muscle fiber has many myonuclei. Now, one of their main functions is to produce protein for the muscle to maintain or alter its size and function by producing muscle protein. They can only produce so much protein, though, so growing more muscle typically requires additional myonuclei to be added to the muscle that usually comes from satellite cell recruitment and maturation. Now, this adaptive mechanism occurs through resistance training in general, but is also one of the mechanisms by which super physiological doses of testosterone can increase muscle size. And there's also some evidence that supplementing with creatine does this as well. You actually get more myonuclei per muscle fiber. They can produce more protein. So you got more muscle protein, your muscle actually gets bigger. Okay. Now, during detraining, the myonuclei produce less protein in response to the environmental change. Not lifting weights, doesn't need to produce more protein, so it produces less. And subsequently, the muscle gets smaller. The myonuclear permanence hypothesis suggests these myonuclei persist and that when the individual gets back to training, they regrow muscle and regain strength more rapidly than they did initially to get back to where they were, because these myonuclei have been hanging around just waiting for a signal to turn back on. Now, the evidence on this is incomplete. Most short-term studies show that myonuclei do persist during periods of detraining, though extreme examples like spinal cord injury, complete bed rest, etc., show myonuclei loss as soon as 1 week. Longer-term studies are lacking, and no one has really followed folks who are well-trained and then become detrained, but not severely ill, injured, or malnourished, and then retrained. So I think the theory may be partially true, but more study is needed. Now, another potential mechanism may be related to these persistent neural adaptations, which actually speaks to what Dr. Baraki was talking about with respect to strength being sort of a skill. You need to have things like coordination, movement proficiency, and other specific movement-specific skills that would allow rapid restoration of strength, the ability to use heavier weights than maybe you were before when you completely untrained, and maybe more effective training compared to those who are completely untrained. Whether or not that's strictly neurally based, or whether there's other sort of persistent adaptations with respect to sort of work capacity, training tolerance, etc., unclear. That is another suggested mechanism. The final suggested mechanism for this is that individuals become resensitized to exercise after a break, where a number of molecular mechanisms that are involved in muscle hypertrophy become blunted after continuous training and more responsive to training stimuli after a break. There's not any like longitudinal outcomes on that currently available, where, again, they have people become well-trained, stop training, and then become well-trained again. And they measure these mechanisms and say, oh, yeah, wow, that is the reason. We don't really have data on that. It's more speculative at this point. So to me, I'm academically satisfied with all these potential mechanisms, but I'm curious to see what comes down the pike in the months and years to come.
Yeah, I think all in all, this is just good news, almost regardless of how you slice it, for people, as far as if you are able to train even reasonably consistently with a reasonable strength and conditioning program, you're likely to get decent results. I think that's an uncontroversial take. The idea that you, as you mentioned earlier, to the extent that you are able to train more overall over a longer period of time, you are more likely to accrue greater adaptations. Also an uncontroversial take from this. But I think the best news is, again, that, you know, especially for people who really enjoy training and who are really motivated by outcomes, you know, if things go sideways for a little bit, not all hope is lost.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the metaphor I want to use is that this is kind of like what we see with calorie restriction. So people, for example, want to perseverate on the daily calorie deficit, for example, or like even a weekly calorie deficit, when in reality, people's weight trajectory, so how much they weigh, is more governed by what is happening over a longer period of time. Let's call it a month or multiple months. And I think training adaptations are about the same way. People, again, perseverate over what's happening each week, or training session to training session, or week to week, or even over a month. But I suspect the actual, you know, time unit that we should be looking at is multiple months. Maybe it's quarterly training volume, for example. So when people are like, oh, I have a trip this weekend, so I can't train my normal, you know, Thursday or Friday session. Like, what should I do? I'm like, train Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Just like, that's fine. Because what's really going to matter is, over these 3 months or 6 months even, like, how many sessions did you get in and what did you do in those sessions? I think that's probably more predictive than what's happening on a singular week or even a single month. Does that strike you as being patently false, or like more plausible than not?
Yeah, I think we are ultimately landing in a similar spot on this as far as our take. And hopefully people can, you know, you don't need to worry so much about the details of the particular study, but rather this is a paper whose kind of general conclusions, general take homes can be pretty useful for most average trainees. Yep. As far as their decision making and how much they agonize over these things day to day, particularly if they're a pretty highly motivated trainee. Again, just kind of giving yourself a little bit of space for, you know, the ebbs and flows. It's okay. I mean, I think about both of our training. We've had ups and downs and injuries and setbacks and, you know, unintentional breaks forced on us for various reasons at certain periods of time. And ultimately, so far to date, we've managed to come back from pretty much all of them and get stronger than we ever were before. You know, yeah, take that for what it is.
At some point, we'll lift the most weight that we'll ever lift in our whole lives, and we won't even know it.
Yeah, deep.
Deep. Hey, everyone. I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. As we gather with loved ones this Thanksgiving, consider how learning a new language can enhance your connections and enrich your experiences. You guys know I've been trying to learn French using a competitor, Babbel, before I was endorsing Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for my trip to France, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Now, Rosetta Stone was the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice, along with the correct accent, using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off by visiting rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off on limited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life by redeeming 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy this fall. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the cooking fatigue, and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options. Find guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops. Also, feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Now, if you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up, and according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine podcast with Dr. Austin Baracchi. It's our November 2024 research review. We're going to be talking about huffing carbon monoxide for gains now. And nope, don't adjust your headset. Don't adjust your volume. That is real. The title of this paper is called Carbon Monoxide Supplementation, Evaluating Its Potential to Enhance Altitude Training Effects and Cycling Performance in Elite Athletes. All right, this is by Uranistad and his research group out of Europe. It was recently published in the Journal of Applied Physiology. All right, so we're going to do a little background here, and Austin's going to take you on a magic school bus through some interesting physiology. I'll set him up for this. So altitude training has been widely used in endurance sports for enhancing maximal endurance performance. At high altitudes, the partial pressure of oxygen is lower than it is at sea level, for example, which tends to result in lower levels of oxygen in the blood. This is called hypoxemia. As an adaptive process, the body finds ways to increase the amount of oxygen it can carry at once so as not to be persistently low on oxygen. Body in general is averse to having insufficient oxygen, and so it has multiple redundant mechanisms in place and processes in place where it can fix that. So the main physiological mechanism by which endurance performance improves from altitude training is the stimulation of erythropoietin, or EPO, release, mainly from the kidneys, which increases the formation of red blood cells. And you got more red blood cells that are being formed from the bone marrow. Well, that allows you to carry more oxygen, more red blood cells, more oxygen in the blood, more performance potentially. Now, by increasing the numbers of cells that carry oxygen, yep, more oxygen is available, and that can be transported to the working muscles. Red blood cells also help at buffering lactate, which is created during strenuous endurance exercise. And altitude training has also been shown to increase the number of mitochondria in skeletal muscle and improve exercise economy. The increase in VO2 max and performance through altitude training is thought to be the result of a combination of these factors, including better oxygen carrying capacity and enhanced oxygen kinetics. That's basically just how the oxygen is delivered and offloaded in the actual tissues that need it. All right. The beneficial effects of altitude training are usually observed at about 2,300 to 2,500 meters above sea level. But such altitudes have a number of problems for athletes, such as relatively limited training facilities at this altitude, the high expense of living and training at these sort of facilities, and inclement weather that tends to be a big barrier in some of these locations. To address these limitations, there's a relatively recent strategy, as far as we know, involving daily exposure to carbon monoxide that has been proposed to either amplify altitude training in those who are living at high altitude or as a substitute for those who are training at low altitudes and can't otherwise get to one of these high altitude training facilities. And yeah, I said carbon monoxide. That's the one that you've seen on TV with the carbon monoxide detectors and such. It's an odorless, tasteless, colorless, non-irritating gas, so people aren't usually aware. And in fact, in this study, they asked folks if if they knew what substance they were inhaling, right? Just to see, like, do you know what you're taking, or are you
to see if they were unblinded during the study? Yeah,
yeah. 44% of them said we have no, like, they got the answer wrong. So that's, I thought that was pretty interesting. Maybe more interesting was that 66% then apparently would actually know that they are inhaling carbon monoxide. So does that mean that they were doing it before and they kind of knew what their physiological response would be to, like, short-term exposure to carbon monoxide? That's maybe for another podcast. But in general, the atmospheric concentration of carbon monoxide is very low, like 0.001%, but it may be higher in urban areas or enclosed environments like your garage. For example, carbon monoxide, when it's in the body, it binds to hemoglobin, those are your red blood cells, the protein in your red blood cells, with a much greater affinity than oxygen. So it can, like, displace oxygen and prevent it from binding, for example. And it forms this molecule called carboxyhemoglobin, which limits effective oxygen transport and utilization. Now, before we go any further, this can be a problem. Carbon monoxide poisoning is real. It is estimated to occur in about 50,000 people every year in the United States, mostly due to non-fire-related smoke inhalation, and it's responsible for about 1,000 to 1,300 deaths annually. Now, we're not talking about starting a fire in a training facility and huffing it, but also when you think about carbon monoxide inhalation, I know your physiology brain is just tipped off and running wild. Like, how do you frame this for folks if they're like, how could this possibly supplant or replace or substitute altitude training?
Yeah, and this is a super, yeah, you're right, super interesting to me to geek out on the physiology of this and how it's being used here to try to augment the adaptations that will then benefit aerobic performance. And so people will be familiar probably with just the use of EPO. In the context of sport, this is something that historically was known to be rampant in, like, Tour de France cyclists, probably still is to some extent. You know, the original method was blood doping, just give yourself more blood. Well, when that was, you know, no longer a feasible option, they bypassed giving yourself blood and instead giving yourself EPO to make your body produce more of your own blood. That requires an injection of EPO to achieve that. But when that is, if that's not feasible and you know, you're trying to work around these anti-doping rules and limitations and things like that, if you can't give yourself blood and you can't give yourself the shot that'll make your body make blood, then you're trying to think, okay, well, what sort of conditions can I put my body in that will then make it release its own EPO, which will then make me make more of my own blood? So we're trying to find different pathways and strategies to ultimately achieve the same goal. And the one that is, I guess, allowed, legal, is altitude training, as you mentioned. Something that I did a bit. I didn't go to extremely high altitude, but we did a little bit of that. And the idea is that when you go up to altitude, there's relatively less oxygen in the air. Since there's less oxygen in the air, less oxygen is getting down into your blood, and your body, namely your kidneys, sense that there is less oxygen around and says, well, if there's less oxygen around to fit into my cars, in my blood, the cars being your red blood cells, then I just need a whole bunch more vehicles. I need to pack many, many, many more of them around to pick up whatever oxygen they can as a compensatory mechanism. It's an elegant, amazing, adaptive kind of phenomenon. And so training at altitude is done, will still be done, is allowed. There's no rule against it by any means. And people who live at really high altitudes, they naturally live with really high hemoglobin levels. So now we're looking for what ways, short of actually going up to altitude, as you mentioned, there's a lot of inconveniences to that, can we use to mimic it? And so, you know, that was the theory behind those, like, altitude masks that got really popular a few years ago, even though those don't particularly work. Those don't really tend to generate true hypoxemia or low blood oxygen levels, so not the best option. But we're trying to find other ways to mimic that state of hypoxemia, tricking the kidneys into releasing EPO. We're trying to trick the kidneys to make them think, okay, there's not enough oxygen being carried around in my blood, so I need to make a whole bunch more blood to scavenge, to pick up, and to carry whatever oxygen I can. So there are various ways to do this. And we know, for example, this is not in the context of sport, but cigarette smoking is known to generate people with COPD who have chronic lung disease. They are less effective at getting oxygen into their blood, and they can become polycythemic. Polycythemia referring to really elevated hemoglobin levels in their blood. It's compensatory because due to the smoking effects on the lungs, chronic lung damage, and the fact that when people smoke cigarettes, they are also inhaling a bit of carbon monoxide. All of that leads to a state of low oxygen in the blood, tricks the kidneys into making more blood cells. And so chronic smokers, chronic COPD, even people with sleep apnea whose blood oxygen levels dip down in the middle of the night because they are failing to breathe, pretty common for them to develop significant polycythemia. I remember seeing a patient last year who had, I think, the highest hemoglobin I had ever seen. I think it was about 22 grams per deciliter, and he was pretty purple in the face because of how much excess blood he had. He had bad lungs, he had untreated COPD, untreated sleep apnea, etc. And so this paper and some, you know, kind of analogous situations involve the use of substances that bind hemoglobin, like carbon monoxide. And so once you bind up the hemoglobin and the blood contains relatively less oxygen, then the kidneys become tricked. They think, gosh, I'm not seeing the same amount of oxygen being carried around in the blood as I normally do, so let me crank out some EPO and as a result make more blood. And there are other substances that are also known to either directly or indirectly trigger the release of EPO. Cobalt toxicity is another one. So cobalt is something, it's a heavy metal that can be ingested. And some of the cases in recent years have come from cobalt that's been in prosthetic hip implants that leached into the blood and then had consequences. Those fortunately are not being used anymore. And then interestingly, other kind of substances like xenon is another one, that noble gas is another one that can be used to generate this state and trigger the release of EPO. So ultimately, if you recognize like, hey, the original blood dopers had the right idea, just giving themselves units of blood, and all of this other stuff is just ways of not going quite as far as transfusing yourself, but rather tricking your body into thinking that it needs to make more blood.
Yeah. Or you could be like Finland's distance skier, Eero Matoranta. So he's in the 1960s, he won a bunch of Olympic medals, 5 Olympic medals, 2 gold, 1 silver, and 2 bronze. He actually had an EPO receptor gene mutation that resulted in his EPO levels being about 65% higher than anyone else not taking EPO. And there was actually a ban placed upon him and others with the same mutation. Because effectively, that country, Finland, was just crushing all of these winter distance of sports events because they had a higher genetic mutation rate. Adaptive, you know, for their sport.
Yeah.
Sport selected them. They didn't select the sport, maybe, so to speak. But
it just brings up one of our favorite topics. I mean, it's quote unquote not fair, but sports aren't fair. They had they hit the genetic lottery for that particular sport. They would have been terrible at a different sport, but as you said, the sport picked them. I don't think they should have been banned, but you know, that's
me. Yeah. Yeah. It was a temporary ban for a few years. Now, Austin, if you had to pick one, like physiological, or it could just be straight physical, right? So you could just go something anthropometry wise, one mutation to have, right? Which presumably to be awesome at sport or some other sort of thing that affected your earnings potential or power status, something. What would you pick and why?
Oh man, this is a tough one. I think stratifying it among like aerobic sport or strength power sport, or as you said, just like, I don't know, academic, like, I don't know. I don't know about you. I'm like pretty content with my genetic lottery. I think I could have hit the jackpot higher in like aerobic kind of capacity, like the mutation that gentleman had, because I feel like I ended up in a higher performing state in strength sport than I ever did in aerobic conditioning endurance sport. I think I probably am a better lifter than I was a swimmer, and so it would be interesting to have one of those. I can't name a specific mutation, but one of those freaky ones that lets you be just incredible as far as like an aerobic adapted athlete.
I would pick something to do with height. I would just end up being a 7-foot-tall person, mainly because if you're between the ages of 18 and 45, and you live in the United States, there's a greater than 20% chance that you play in the NBA right now. And damn, that would be fun. Like short period of time in the NBA, they'd be like, he has the worst jump shot in the history of the NBA, but he's tall. So, and I feel like I could just exist being tall and that would be fine. For
yeah,
a little bit.
While true, and I can't speak to the nuances of the evidence based on this. If I recall, I think that people who are taller, especially to that level, I think on average have a bit shorter lifespan. So there would be
a
trade-off to be there.
But I'm going to die earlier anyway. Yeah, I'm going to die earlier anyway. It's fine. All right. Well, previous studies have shown that an increase in EPO from inhaled carbon monoxide in elite athletes actually does increase performance. So like VO2 max and running economy, that's been shown as early as like 2019 as one of the studies I found. So this particular study that was recently published aimed to further investigate carbon monoxide inhalation as a performance enhancing sort of aid, this time in elite cyclists. So what did they do? 31 high-level cyclists volunteered to basically be in this study, and 20 of them volunteered to relocate to a region of Italy that's located at 2,100 meters above sea level to basically train at altitude for a three-week training camp. So they were further stratified into three separate groups. Group one was 10 individuals. They were in the live high, train high group, and they also got supplemental carbon monoxide twice per day to increase their carboxyhemoglobin concentration to about 10%. All right. So that's not like obviously a lethal level or dangerous level, but it is significantly higher than where what you would otherwise see, even if you were training at altitude. So it's like high altitude training on steroids. In this case, the steroid is carbon monoxide. Another 10 elite level cyclists were also training at altitude, but they got no supplemental carbon monoxide. And then finally, the last 11 actually trained at their home towns, which were not at high elevation. So they were the live low, train low group. So they lived at home, not at elevation. They were basically the controls for the study to see how both of these protocols kind of differed in results. The athletes maintained their normal training throughout. So they weren't on a specific training program that was standardized across these sort of the different athletes, because they were elite level already. The researchers were like, we'll let them do whatever they were doing before. Interestingly, there were no real differences between groups in training volume, intensity distribution, or how much strength training volume they did, which is actually, I mean, you think about 30 different power lifters, right? If you like put them in a training camp and you assessed all of their training, you would expect there to be a relatively wide range of differences in how they went about their programming. But all of these people kind of ended up at the same spot. And I crunched some numbers. About 77% of their training intensity distribution was in zones one and zone two, and the remaining 23% was zone three and above, so kind of that 80-20 rule that we've been talking about for a while. And they, on average, did about a half hour per week of resistance training, which to me, I'm like, okay, so let's say that was twice per week. Is that one lift? They like went in
15 minutes, 2 days a week. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they went in, they squatted a few sets, left, and the next time they came in, they deadlifted a few sets. Probably not. They're probably not deadlifting, but a boy can dream. They also, so to measure the sort of effects to see if there were any differences, they measured blood hematocrit and blood hemoglobin. Austin, you want to talk about just real quick, like what those two things are? Because we get that in a blood test all the time, but I want to make sure our listeners know what blood hematocrit is and what blood hemoglobin is.
Yeah, fundamentally, you know, these are two different measures relating to red blood cells, which contain the hemoglobin protein that carries around oxygen. And I think as far as oxygen carrying capacity and oxygen delivery goes, that's where we pay much more attention to blood hemoglobin. So for me, like in medical practice in the hospital, overwhelmingly, I care about people's hemoglobin and I pay far less attention to people's hematocrit in most situations. The exception is that at very high levels, where oxygen carrying capacity is no longer at all the question, at very high levels, what you start to worry about more is blood viscosity, the thickness of the blood, because as blood gets very, very, very thick, that can end up leading to dysfunction of various organs. It can lead to unpleasant symptoms, blurred vision, headache, hypertension, all sorts of other things. And that's where hematocrit tends to be more of the dominant variable that impacts that. And there's a ton of interesting, like, I guess, comparative physiology among different mammals as far as where they settle out, as far as their kind of equilibrium point of hemoglobin and hematocrit to balance the oxygen carrying capacity from the hemoglobin side and the viscosity side from the hematocrit side. So that's what those two measurements are telling us.
There you go. They also measured VO2 max, so how much oxygen these people can take up. And then while they were doing these VO2 max tests, what their lactate levels were, so that sort of profile, and also how much power they were able to put out while they were doing this sort of graded exercise test. right? So as far as results go, now, again, this was only after a 3-week sort of training camp, so relatively short duration study. And again, all highly trained athletes, all right? So when I say these numbers, people say, ah, that's not that big. But it's like, dude, this is only 3 weeks in a highly trained sample size. So this could actually be significant as far as its implications on subsequent performance. So blood hematocrit, for example, in the group that was living high, training high, and got the carbon monoxide, that went up about 3.6% in that group after the 3 weeks. In the live high, train high group that did not get carbon monoxide, it only went up 2.2%. And then the live low, train low group, it only went up by 1%. Same thing for blood hemoglobin. It went up 5.8% in those getting the carbon monoxide who were also training at elevation compared to only 1.8% at those who were training high and living high but did not get any carbon monoxide. It basically did not change at all in those who were living low and training low.
That's the thing that I would say matters, right? So mm-hmm. again, paying attention to hemoglobin as far as oxygen carrying capacity goes, a big difference in hemoglobin between groups, I would be, you know, I would expect to mediate a difference in performance outcomes here, more so than the hematocrit outcome, which is not necessarily reflective of oxygen carrying capacity within kind of minor differences of one another. And additionally, hematocrit can be impacted by other things like hydration status, among many other things. So a difference in hemoglobin is what I would care about more for performance. And this is a interesting, notable difference here among the groups.
Yeah, they actually also made mention that sometimes just training at altitude actually produces some level of dehydration due to the hyperventilation, and subsequently you get this respiratory alkalosis, and so mm-hmm. you have to compensate and you become dehydrated, whereas carbon monoxide inhalation does not actually produce dehydration, and we know that dehydration can reduce performance. So is it possible that carbon monoxide supplementation is actually better than training at altitude? We'll see how that plays out. Now, on the VO2 max, yes, it went up more in those getting carbon monoxide compared to those who were just training at high altitude but got no carbon monoxide, so by an additional percent or so, which, again, is not nothing, because at this level, you expect their VO2 maxes to all be like pretty much maxed out. As long as they were actively training, you expect their VO2 max to be near peak. So for it to go up further and have a differential sort of effect, that to me is pretty impressive. They also had the individuals who were getting carbon monoxide had greater power output throughout the sort of graded exercise test, and they were able to have a slightly higher lactate threshold, which was also, again, potentially predictive of performance. So overall, improved hemoglobin, improved hematocrit levels, improved power output at the lactate threshold and VO2 max with carbon monoxide supplementation compared to just living high and training at high altitudes. So my interpretation here, mechanistically, none of this is surprising to me. You laid out the physiology, kind of predicted what the response would be, and yeah, we saw it. Now, endurance athletes have been trying to increase the red blood cell mass for a long time, as it is tightly correlated with VO2 max, which is an important but not the sole determinant of performance. It's been done with altitude training, blood doping, as you referenced earlier, the use of EPO or erythropoietin, and others have been used with varying levels of success and safety, to say nothing of whether or not it's legal in sport. However, I would have liked to see some more concrete differences in performance in this particular trial. So like if they did a 20-minute, you know, max distance sort of test, for example, or actually we did this training camp and they all went to the same race, here's how they did. To me, that would give a more sort of instructive or illustrative view of the magnitude of effect, like if there really was a difference. Now, granted, that's more complicated than just what happened to these physiological parameters. But as a coach and as an athlete, I'd still want to see it.
Yeah, this is my counter, or I guess the counter that you already know and can anticipate. But you remember watching that Netflix documentary Icarus a few years ago, where the guy was he was a documentary, you know, producer, but he was also a cyclist, and he wanted to enter this event, and he wanted to, in documentary form, go on all the drugs and see what impact it had on his performance. He did all these different, you know, performance enhancing drugs. He was monitored by a physician. He went through this whole protocol, and then he got to race day, and his like bike chain broke or something like that. And so it ended up, he was like, well, that was a bust.
Yeah. They also didn't, there was no comment on any like adverse effects in any of the individuals, perhaps because they didn't have any. That's possible. Or perhaps because they weren't asked. So it's hard to really know here. Or maybe they were always using carbon monoxide before, and so they tolerated it well. We just don't really know.
Yeah. I think that the issue here is that, you know, carbon monoxide in terms of its effects are going to be on a spectrum, right? So like a normal level being zero, but even, you know, even among routine non-smokers, anywhere from like 0 to 3% can be considered normal in terms of carboxyhemoglobin. Among smokers, it can be 0 to 10%. Some have suggested maybe upwards of 15% that we might see in smokers. And of course, it's difficult to separate out, you know, among smokers, what like quote unquote symptoms are they having from smoking versus from carbon monoxide alone or other adverse health effects. Severe poisoning from carbon monoxide toxicity tends to emerge at levels greater than like 25% or so. And so it's going to be a whole spectrum within there. And then a lot of the kind of one of the more common, you know, end organs that is affected by this is the brain. And that's the one that we worry about the most when it comes to managing medically, like people with significant carbon monoxide toxicity when it's well over that 25% threshold. But again, since it's a graded spectrum, at lower levels of, you know, quote unquote toxicity or poisoning in those intermediate ranges, it might actually be difficult to specifically identify a very particular symptom that they might report. It might just be like a little bit of some brain fog or like a little bit of some mild, you know, lightheadedness or something that they might not have otherwise reported. But again, it's all just going to be a spectrum, and none of them, fortunately, I mean, that's because they did the study in as reasonable a way as you could for something that's giving, you know, your subjects carbon monoxide, not enough to generate significant toxicity to the subjects.
Yeah. Well, that actually brings up maybe a more important concern here, the ethical question surrounding the use of carbon monoxide. So there were some press reports in this past Tour de France of actual riders in this last Tour de France using carbon monoxide. And so, like, should it be allowed? Because it's not currently on the banned list on WADA or USADA or any other sort of doping control. So to your point, it does seem like it can be relatively safe if administered in the appropriate dose. But athletes, as they are wont to do, may be tempted to use higher doses. Look, if 10% carboxyhemoglobin level is good, shit, 20% might be better. Let's send it. And then what about monitoring, right? If you are on a very, you know, affluent sort of team that has access to like all this monitoring stuff, physicians and other people, then maybe that's less of a concern. But what if you're in a resource limited sort of a situation and then you're just left to your own devices? That to me, I have some concerns. What do you think?
Yeah, this topic is, I think we both agree it's super interesting, even if neither of us can come up with good answers. It's just that, like, at some point, somebody's going to have to come up with a policy, but there's always going to be these scenarios where it's like, well, this is kind of hypocritical, or this doesn't entirely make sense, right? So there's no ban against people going up to altitude and generating hypoxemia, leading to EPO production, leading to increased blood mass, right? And so here's a scenario where they're, you know, breathing this substance that can generate the same physiologic effects. And it's something that, relatively speaking, is going to be kind of difficult to detect, right? So if you're just breathing regular room air, 21% oxygen, the half-life of carbon monoxide is like 5 hours and it's gone. Yeah. So it's not going to be something that you can easily test for the presence of. And I saw in one of the commentaries, they were like, well, you know, do people feel differently about this because they're just like breathing this in? Would it be different if they were injecting carbon monoxide the way you inject EPO? Does something about that act make it feel, you know, more sinister and it needs to be banned? It's just all made up, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
it is natural. Like, so is EPO and so is testosterone, but we do ban those things if taken by injection or at super physiological doses. So like, why is this any different? But you kind of already alluded to my main problem here is, well, if we're going to ban it, how do we test for it? And that's really my bigger issue with drug testing at large anyway in sport. It's like we have so many things on the banned list that we can't adequately test for, as evidenced by the fact that the majority of people who are using PEDs, which is a large swath of the athletic population, particularly at elite levels, do not get caught. And the people who do get caught, it apparently does not disincentivize them or others from using again in the future. So like, our current policy is inadequate and not particularly evidence-based. And so I think my take on this is that I can appreciate the safety concerns, although the poison's in the dose and that's not really unique to carbon monoxide. I don't have any feelings about the naturalness or artificialness of like supplementing this. My main problem here is monitoring it. Right. So if we are going to ban it or regulate it on some level, how are you going to do it? It doesn't mean that just because I don't know the answer doesn't mean it's not solvable. I just don't have an answer for it right now. So I think that any policy surrounding its use has to reflect that and be like, yeah, we don't feel awesome about this. We don't know. And we also don't know how to test for it. So like, what are we supposed to do about that?
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, the clinical scenarios in which I'm familiar with carbon monoxide testing is when there's concern for active ongoing toxicity, where you test blood levels and it's not for performance enhancing purposes, where you're looking for this kind of like sub-toxic kind of level. I mean, the other interesting thing, as I said, is they don't ban going to train at altitude. Would they ban you from like living in a very urban, industrially polluted area that has a lot of carbon monoxide in it? Would they ban you from being in your garage for a little, for, you know, a few minutes a day, a couple hours a day, whatever, just to get a little bit of this this dose? Or cigarette smoking, right? Like technically, of course, it's not super ergogenic. It can be for certain things in terms of the nicotine effects. And apparently it could be a little bit potentially ergogenic from the carbon monoxide side of things. Are those going to be banned in sport? It's just a gigantic mess. And neither of us claim to be the people who are going to lead the charge to give, you know, some sort of elegant policy to handle all this, I don't think.
I just imagine a scenario where, you know, some city is established at elevation somewhere between 2,200, 2,500 meters above sea level. And then they intentionally industrialize the area just for max pollution. So not only do you get the elevation, but you get the carbon monoxide, but you don't have to take any exogenous, you know, supplemental carbon monoxide. It's just there. They're just running, you know, diesel trucks and like cars from the 70s with no catalytic converters, like, you know, until their engine tires out just continuously. And the athletes are just living in the smog-filled dystopian industrial hellscape area.
Yeah.
They're outside on their, you know, balconies on their trainers, just like,
yeah.
They end up with all these like lung diseases, but damn, they were fast.
Their hemoglobin cracks 30 and then they can, you know, run real fast until they get a PE from it or something. I don't know.
Yeah, the next trek, you know, U.S. postal team, they're all purple because they're just the blood's so thick and their, you know, hemoglobin's through the roof. I don't know. Something like that. All right. Well, that's been a wrap here on the November 2024 research review. A special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracki for sharing his expertise with us. Again, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum here with Barbell Medicine. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey everyone, it's Dr. Jordan here, and from everyone at Barbell Medicine, we want to say thank you for all of your support this year. Truly, we couldn't do what we do without you, so in the spirit of Thanksgiving and the holiday weekend, thank you so much. And with that in mind, I wanted to tell you about our biggest sale of the year going on this weekend only. From now through Monday, everything on the website is on sale. You can take 20% off our one-on-one coaching from some of the most experienced coaches in the game. We only do this once a year, so if you were on the fence about working with a professional coach, there's no better time than now. Outside of coaching, our training templates, whey protein, PeriRx supplement, and our freshly restocked apparel are all marked down 20% as well. We're even discounting our Barbell Medicine Plus membership for a limited time only, so you can get ad-free listening, exclusive content, and support what we do here at Barbell Medicine for up to 30% off. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/shop and check it out. You can stock up on gifts for your favorite workout enthusiast with special deals on coaching, apparel, templates, supplements, and more. That's barbellmedicine.com/shop. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and thanks again.
Shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com.